www.kci.org and check out the news section for all upcoming events, guest speakers, DJs, and live bands. KUCI Radio, broadcasting from UC Irvine since 1969.
Hey there, this is Chancellor Ralph Cicerone, and when I'm at research conferences all around the world about global warming, I tune in to KUCI for music and talk radio over the internet at kuci.org. You crazy kids, remember to carpool and plant a tree.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Good morning, and welcome to Campus Talk on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is host Doug Hill, and Campus Talk is a show where we talk to interesting people who are doing interesting things at the University of California and in Irvine. And our guest this morning is Dr. Yaron Brook from the Ayn Rand Institute. Welcome, Dr. Brook.
Thanks for having me on.
And thank you very much for being here. You are the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute.
That's right.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about who Ayn Rand was?
Sure. Ayn Rand is probably familiar to most of your listeners from her novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, both books sell today hundreds of thousands of copies. Total Ayn Rand sales today in excess of half copies, more than when she was alive.
Half a million copies total or half a million copies per year?
Half a million per year. Total is in excess of, I think, 22, 23 million copies sold. She, as I said, she sells more books today than when she was alive. Ayn Rand was born in 1905, almost exactly 100 years ago, in Russia, St. Petersburg, Russia. She grew up in a secular Jewish family as Eliza Rosenblum. And
so Ayn Rand is a pen name then?
Yes, it is. It's a name she adopted as a pen name when she moved to the United States in the 1920s. She moved here to escape communism. She witnessed the 1917 revolution in the Soviet Union from her balcony in St. Petersburg. The first shots were fired in the square below. She managed to get out of the country and made it actually to Hollywood. She wanted to work for the movies. She wanted to write for movies. And indeed, she worked for the beginning of her career in Hollywood. Wrote a book called We the Living, which is probably the closest thing to a biographical work that she ever wrote about her, really about the heroine is in the Soviet Union and about the conditions under communism in Russia at the time. And really was, this is the 1930s when the book came out, and she was completely rejected by most intellectuals in this country in the 1930s, who were really dominated by the communists, socialists, who dominated the intelligentsia, particularly on the East Coast. Later on, went on to write The Fountainhead, which was a bestseller. Publishers rejected it. She finally found a publisher and turned out to be a bestseller. And, of course, today sells well over 100,000 copies a year. And then her magnus opus was Atlas Shrugged, which she completed in 1957 in a survey done by the Library of Congress, I think about 10 years ago. People were asked what was the most influential book in their lives, and Atlas Shrugged came in second after the Bible.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's hard to meet a successful person, businessmen, even politicians, although they're not impacted really, who won't tell you that Atlas Shrugged was a significant influence in their lives. Most CEOs, I think, in America read Atlas Shrugged and been inspired by it.
Now, I understand you have a celebration coming up for the 100th anniversary of her birth.
Yes. Anniversary is February 2nd, and we're holding an event at the Ayn Rand Institute in Irvine that evening from 6 o'clock to 6 p.m. And then the whole weekend, the following weekend, on Friday, we've got a free talk at the Westin in South Coast Plaza starting at 7:30.
7:30 Friday.
February
5th, okay.
And that is that will be on the virtue of selfishness. And then on Saturday, the following Saturday, February 6th, we will have a whole day of programs, four talks during the day, and then a celebration dinner in the evening. And then on Sunday morning, there'll be a breakfast talk. If anybody wants information on that, just go to our website, www.aynrand.org.
And maybe you better spell that for the
yes.
people.
Yes, A-Y-N-R-A-N-D AYNRAND.org. AYNRAND.org. Click on the centenary events. These are the events to celebrate the 100th birthday of Ayn Rand.
Yeah, why is Ayn Rand important?
Ayn Rand's important because primarily in Atlas Shrugged, and then in a number of books following Atlas Shrugged, nonfiction books, she developed a unique and revolutionary, I believe, philosophy. A philosophy, as she said, to guide man's life, a philosophy for living, and really a comprehensive philosophy, a philosophy that covers most, if not all, of the important questions philosophers have been asking for thousands of years. And she developed this new philosophy, a revolutionary philosophy, and a philosophy that has really inspired many, many people over the last few decades. And
now, the name of her philosophy is objectivism.
Objectivism.
Is that right? Objectivism.
That's
okay.
Right.
What is objectivism?
Objectivism, let me go through kind of the key points in objectivism. Ayn Rand believed that reality is what it is, that the desk in front of us is really there. And she was really going against the notion that we make up reality, what she called the primary of consciousness, where reality is really in our consciousness and we make it up as we go along. Or for that matter, that there is some higher being that has created reality and manipulates it. Reality is what it is, the laws of science, the laws of nature function. And we, as human beings, are equipped to know what reality is. And
okay, so just to get into a little philosophy here, she's making both, forgive me for using a technical term, an ontological claim. That is a claim about what exists. That's all that's saying. So reality exists. And she's also, she seems like there's two claims. She's also making a claim that this is knowable.
Yes.
Right?
She's saying that this is knowable, and we have the tool to know it, and that tool is reason. Our senses are valid, she says, and we are equipped with a mind, a reasoning mind, that can evaluate reality, identify reality, and know reality. Contrast this with the skepticism that exists today in philosophy department. Reality is unknowable. We have no clue, starting with Immanuel Kant. Reality is in another dimension that we can't really observe. It's all filtered. What we see is really, again, created by our consciousness. And and the other extreme is again, religion, where the idea is that the only way we know reality is, or the real knowledge of reality is through some kind of mystical revelation, which she was completely against. The only way of knowing reality is through human reason. There is no such thing as revelation. So that's metaphysics and then epistemology. And you move into ethics, Ayn Rand advocated for rational egoism, for rational self-interest. The purpose of life is one's own well-being, one's own happiness,
and
fulfilling
so
one's
and so,
own life.
And so in this case about rational self-interest, she's following the example of Thomas Hobbes, although coming to a rather different conclusion. Right?
I wouldn't say she's following Thomas Hobbes. She's really following Aristotle, if anybody. She is really advocating. She's saying, let's look at human nature and trying to derive a ethical system from nature, rather than most systems believe that we either get our ethics from, again, mystical revelation from God, or from somehow some kind of social consciousness, some kind of revelation that society or the group creates. She's saying, well, let's look scientifically at nature and try to see what is an appropriate morality for human existence, for human life. And when you look at nature, you observe that all animals, anything that is alive, including plants, really, face a choice. They face a choice of to survive or not to survive, to exist or not to exist. Plants, if you put them away from the light, they'll try to, they'll change their route. They'll change their growth pattern in order to try to access light, try to go for what is good for their lives. And then, so she asked the question, if we are one more biological entity out there, one more animal out there, what is good for our lives? What is the light, the equivalent of light for human beings? And that is the good. What is good for human life is the good. What endangers human life, what is bad for human life, is the bad.
Well,
is
there a problem in this, in that what's good for one person may be bad for another person?
No. Fundamentally, we all survive through the same means. Fundamentally, what is good for one person is the same as what is good for another person. But let's do an exercise for a second. What allows human beings to survive? From primitive societies on to today, what is it that makes it possible for us to have food, to have shelter, to have clothing? We're not born with instincts that provide any of these things. Somebody had to figure all these things out. Somebody had to figure out how to build a hut. Somebody had to figure out how to plant wheat. And those are all good things because they enable life and they make it possible for our lives to prosper. Now, what is it about all those things that, what is it that made all those things possible? Well, it's the human mind. It's rationality. It is reason. In that sense, rationality.
Is it really rationality? Wasn't a lot of the stuff discovered by hit and miss? A lot of the things are, you know, discovered in the ancient world. We don't really know how it happened, but aren't a lot of things discovered by, you know, somebody tries something, wow, this works, well, let's try it, and then other people copy it?
Well, no. I mean, what you're confusing, I think, is the process of induction with the process of hit and miss. Sure, you have to try a lot of things to figure out what works, but the figuring out of what works and what doesn't work, the trying of many things, is the way we learn about reality. It's really the only way we discover new knowledge. That is thinking. Animals don't do that. So somebody was walking, some ancient person was walking along a trail and noticed a seed drop to the ground, and maybe a week later that the seed had sprouted a plant. Now, to connect the seed dropping to sprouting a plant, and maybe it rained in the meantime to water, is an enormous feat of rational thought. That is what rational thought is all about, being able to make those kind of connections, being able to observe those kind of things in reality and draw conclusions from them. And then, sure, he probably tried to plant seed thousands of times until he figured out what worked and what didn't work. But as he was doing that, he was learning. No other animal out there does that, because no other animal has a rational faculty. No other animal has reason that enables it to change its environment around it to make it a better suited for living. So human beings are unique in that sense. We don't accept the environment as it is. The way we survive, the very way we exist, is by changing the environment to suit our means. Living in caves was not efficient because bears are bigger than us and saber-toothed tigers are faster than us and stronger than us. They just eat us up alive. So we had to figure out how to build huts. That is a feat of rationality. That is a feat of the human mind. No other animal can do that. No other animal does that. So when Ayn Rand says reason is a value, rationality is the primary virtue, that is universal. That is not for me, but not for you. It's okay for you to survive just based on feeling or intuition or emotion or revelations that don't exist. The fact is that you can't survive that way. And to the extent that there are people out there who survive without using their minds, it's only because they can leech off of other people who are using their minds. So ultimately, it's the human mind, it's human rationality that allows for our survival. And you can take that entire ethical system, every one of the virtues, every one of the values that she comes up with, is universal in that extent. Nobody survives, nobody can better their life through dishonesty. It just does not happen.
I just don't think that could be true. It seems to me you talk about how people can leech off the work of others. I mean, I think your basic premise is right, that it's knowledge, hard-won knowledge that people have learned and enable us to live in the world and to live as well as we do. You know, and we just had, for example, we just had this big rain, and because we're prepared for it, we built flood channels, and so it could have been a lot worse. When we had this terrible weather a week ago, it could have been a lot worse if we hadn't had all these flood channels and there weren't all these things that we knew that we could do about it. But it seems that some people can prosper by being dishonest because, like you said, they're leeching off the honest work of others.
They can't. They cannot prosper. They can make money. They can have some of the externalities.
So what do you mean about prosper then? What do you mean by prosper?
I mean prosper is, be happy. I mean by prosper, be the best that you can be, to quote a cliche, but fulfill your full potential as a human being.
But don't people get to
live life to the fullest? And I think that dishonesty can, in the short run, and for some people maybe longer than that, can get you money. But it can't. You cannot enjoy that money because the very act of dishonesty is an act that destroys your capacity to enjoy reality. It divorces you from that reality. The very act of dishonesty gives you your consciousness a commandment that says, You know, sometimes I'm going to pay attention to reality, sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm going to fake it. Faking reality is the most devastating thing you can do to yourself.
Well,
and just look around you and you can see that most dishonest people, you can actually see that they're unhappy. You can actually observe it visually. Most dishonest people fail.
I hope you're right about that. I really do. I hope that's right. I'm just not convinced.
It is a tricky point. I'm not saying that I can convince you of this in 5 minutes, but I think it requires some introspection. What happens, for example, when you lie? Let's say, you know, you lie to your wife. You tell her that you were out with friends when you were actually, you were drinking in a bar by yourself with a woman. What happens when your wife meets these other friends? Well, it might slip out. You might ask them. So now you have to tell your friends to lie for you as well. Or you have to cover up the lie with many other lies. Lying leads to more lying. Lying leads to systematization of the lies. And it leads to destruction. And
what about
introspect about your own experiences with this and the experience of people you know, I think you can see that dishonesty just doesn't work. And that's why people don't do it.
I mean, I do believe, I'm not advocating dishonesty as a way of life. Please don't get me wrong, because I do feel it's better. I live a better life being honest most of the time. But what about the little white lies we have to tell? I think there is people who are too honest, who don't know when to lie. Isn't it important to know when to lie, when to tell a lie to spare somebody's feelings?
Well, I think you can, let me define what I mean by dishonesty.
Sure.
Dishonesty means faking reality. Faking reality in order to try to achieve a value, in order to try to get something. Is it appropriate sometimes to tell people when they ask you a question, it's none of your business? Sure. Is it appropriate to lie sometimes? Absolutely, in defense of your values. If somebody knocks on your door, if a rapist knocks on your door and asks you where your wife is, you are obliged to lie to him. That is, a moral obligation to lie to that person because he's trying to take away a value, and in protection of your values, you should lie. He's trying to violate your rights. He's doing something violent. And so I think in cases like that, definitely lying is a must. So dishonesty is really, again, it's faking reality in order to gain a value. And if you're not faking reality in order to gain a value, I wouldn't consider it dishonest, even though it might be a lie.
Okay, what about the lies we tell to spare somebody's feelings, right? Well, certainly we'll tell a lie to... I think it's an easy case to tell a lie to thwart the plans of an evildoer.
Sure.
But what about telling a lie to spare the feelings of a nice person? You know, somebody says, oh, doesn't my daughter look cute in that outfit that I dressed her up in? And you think, no.
Well,
okay,
but
shouldn't you say, I would say yes. I say, oh, yeah, she's... Yeah. That's what I would say.
I mean, I would downplay it if I didn't think it was true.
But you wouldn't lie.
No, I wouldn't say, no, she's ugly. I mean, that would be impolite and inappropriate, absolutely. There is a certain level at which, you know, with human interaction, you fudge. But if you outright tell a lie in such a context, it's going to come back and bite you.
Really? So you would try and dodge the question instead of just telling a quick lie and moving on with it?
I would make it as quick as possible. Yes. If you're going to do that, you do it as quick as possible. You don't elaborate and you make a big deal.
I agree about that.
Okay.
I think that's right. I think that's basically right. Okay. Why is your institute the Ayn Rand Institute? It seems like a lot of these ideas are from other philosophers. Why not the Adam Smith Institute instead?
Well, because Adam Smith did not believe in really any of this philosophy. Adam Smith did not believe in rational egoism. He was in, let me just contrast a minute what rational egoism is to really show how I think revolutionary it is. It really is contrast with altruism, which Adam Smith was definitely an advocate of altruism, which is the notion that you should put other people's well-being before your own. That is, other people's well-being are the primary in any major moral decision, in any moral decision you have to make. You have to think not what is good for me, what is in my long-term rational well-being, but what isn't good is somebody else's well-being. And Adam Smith, when he justified capitalism, he says, the reason capitalism is good is not because it's good for the individual. The reason capitalism is good is it's good for the community, it's good for society, it's good for the group. Indeed, he has a passage where he says, in a conflict between your altruistic duty, between, you know, what would be in your economic self-interest and what would benefit other people. You should always do what is benefit other people. So morally, Adam Smith is very conventional, and I think undercuts his whole advocacy of capitalism because of that, and that's why Adam Smith's form of capitalism has failed. It not prospered in the world around us. It, indeed, the capitalism is declining, I believe.
Wait a
because
second.
Of that, because of the idea that you place the group, society, the community above the interest of the individual.
How can you say that Adam Smith's capitalism has failed? It seems that it's precisely the countries such as the United States which are following this which are doing the best in the world.
Well, no question that capitalism has succeeded qua capitalism. Capitalism is disappearing, particularly in this country. That is, if you take what capitalism should have been, and even Adam Smith, I don't think, was capitalist enough, wasn't for true laissez-faire capitalism. But let's take even the United States. 100 years ago, capitalism was thriving. Capitalism, private enterprise was at the forefront. And there was almost no government intervention in the economy. And you look at the economy today, where the size of government is something like 100 times greater in real terms than what it was back then, where government regulates everything, every aspect of our commercial and economic life, including this radio station, are completely regulated by alphabet agencies like the FCC that all they do is violate the rights of individuals. We have massive government intervention in this country. We live in a mixed economy, a mixture of socialism and capitalism, with socialism growing every year. Socialism becomes more dominant in this country, indeed, every single year.
Well, isn't that just a result of the democratic process? That is, people have chosen, we're going to have some mixture of socialism and capitalism, and we have a political process to make these decisions. Isn't this just, you talk about people's rights, but isn't this just a matter of, balancing people's democratic rights versus their capitalistic rights, and this current balance is the way that we've set it up right now?
Well, that's right, and this is why the Founding Fathers, and I agree with them completely on this, were very against democracy. They objected vehemently to the notion of a democracy. If you read Madison, if you read Jefferson, they wrote extensively about the dangers and harm that democracy brings. Majority rule is not a good thing. It is a bad thing. And that's why we have, for example, a Bill of Rights, supposedly. If the Supreme Court bothered to actually refer to them. But we have a Bill of Rights in order to protect certain rights, for example, free speech. The Founding Fathers said, look, even if the majority believes, democratically, by voting, that you're on me, I don't have a right to voice my opinions, the majority cannot dictate that. I still have a right to speak in spite of the fact that a majority disagrees with me and actually would like to hear me shut up. And I believe that we have moved away from that notion of individual rights, inalienable individual rights, to a point where the Supreme Court today, and really for the last 100 years, is weighs the benefit to the individual with the benefit to society. So free speech is okay under some circumstances, but not okay under other circumstances.
Where is free speech denied? Because it seems
look at Howard Stern. Ask Howard Stern where free speech is denied. Obviously, on the airwave, free speech is denied all the time.
The thing is, he can still broadcast on the internet. That's a totally open forum.
Absolutely,
and now he's broadcasting on the satellite.
But if Infinity owns a radio station, the government has no right to tell it what it can and cannot broadcast on its radio station. That is an infringement of Infinity and Howard Stern's individual right free speech. But let me give you some other examples. Commercial speech is clearly regulated and limited in this. You can't, for example, advertise tobacco in the United States. Why? It's an illegal substance, and you're not allowed to advertise it because the government has said, the Supreme Court indeed has said, that commercial enterprises have no right of speech, which is a clear violation of the founders' intent.
You're right. I think we need to make it
a clear violation of individual rights in any case.
Well, you need to qualify that because tobacco companies do advertise in magazines and newspapers. They're not allowed to broadcast on the airwaves.
Okay, so
they're not allowed to advertise on the airwaves.
Well, no, they're not allowed to put up billboards. They're not allowed to advertise in many places today. But let me put it this way. Okay, so we've only limited free speech some places. We haven't limited it completely. But that is the tendency. It used to be, eminent domain is a big Supreme Court decision in eminent domain. It used to be that eminent domain was relevant when you had to build a highway or wanted to build a sewer. Today, most courts recognize eminent domain that if the community decides that your home is in the way of a Walmart or in the way of economic development or in the way of bettering society in some way, they have a right to just take it.
So there's no property rights in this country anymore. If the community, if the majority decides that there are no property rights,
you say
we've moved away from a society built on individual rights and capitalism towards a society built on majority rule and a movement towards government intervention in every aspect of the economy, i.e. socialism.
You worry about eminent domain, and you say that that's with us now. But didn't the Founding Fathers give us eminent domain? Isn't that something that a government does need to have? Occasionally it might need to take a piece of property for the common good?
No, I don't think eminent domain is a legitimate concept. But what I'm and
but
I
didn't
think
the Founding
that,
Fathers give that
well,
to us?
Well, the Founding Fathers were wrong. I'm not saying
okay.
The Founding Fathers, everything the Founding Fathers
sure.
did was right. All I'm saying is the Founding Fathers were right on one point, and that is that democracy is not a good system. And that's why they established a republic, a constitutional republic. And indeed, they try to separate voters as much as possible from the ultimate decision-making. For example, senators used to be elected by the state House of Representatives. There was no direct election of senators. So the Founding Fathers were very suspicious of democracy, and I think with good reason. And yes, we have moved away from true capitalism. We have moved away from the protection of individual rights because of majority rule, because the courts and our legislature have allowed that to happen through the democratic process. That is a bad thing. Not everything that happens through democracy is good. Most things that happen through democracy, for example, the Athenian democracy sending Socrates to his death, the German democracy voting Hitler into power, and I fear what the Iraqi democracy is going to be doing in a few weeks, are bad things, not good things. So democracies are not solutions. They're typically the problem.
Let's ask you this. If you're anti-democracy,
they tend to sacrifice the individual for the sake of special interest groups or pressure groups, powerful groups within influence politics better than an individual can.
Okay. I just want to tell the listeners we're talking to Dr. Yaron Brook, who's the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. And if you'd like to ask Dr. Brook a question, the number to call is 949-UCI-KUCI. That's 949-824-5824. And here's my next question. You talk about the problems for democracy. Winston Churchill said that democracy is the worst, because you mentioned all these problems with democracies, and democracy surely has these problems of what our Founding Fathers worried about, the majoritarian tyranny, but or the tyranny of the majority. But wasn't Churchill right when he said democracy is the worst possible system except for all the other systems?
No,
what are you proposing?
Well, I'm proposing a political system similar to what the Founding Fathers had in mind. A limited government, limited through a constitution where the constitution is taken seriously. And I think the biggest mistake the Founding Fathers made in our constitution is not explicitly recognizing property rights and not explicitly separating economy from state. Ayn Rand advocated for what she called laissez-faire capitalism, leave-us-alone capitalism, where the government has no, I emphasize, no involvement in the economy, nothing, no regulation, no Social Security. I'm not talking about privatizing Social Security, no Social Security, no welfare, no alphabet agencies, none of them, all of them are gone. If we had a constitutional government that through constitution separated the economy from the state, and where the state only did one thing, but did it really well, and this is where I separate myself from the anarchists / libertarians, we had a very powerful government that did one thing, and that is protect individual rights. It had a strong police force, it had a strong judiciary system, and it had a strong military to protect the United States. If we only did those three things as a state, then you would still have people voting. But the fact is that our representatives wouldn't have much to do. I mean, it would be an electorate that probably wouldn't have to meet, a Congress that wouldn't have to meet that often. There wouldn't be much to do. And, hey, we would all be free to do whatever we wanted to do, as long as we didn't violate other people's rights. And the government would be there to protect us from people violating our rights. And that's it, period. That is a better political system, a constitutional republic with a strict constitution that limits the activities of government. That is a much better political system than a majority-ruled democracy.
Okay, we're going to take a break here. We're talking with Dr. Yaron Brook from the Ayn Rand Institute. We're going to take a break for about 1 minute. If you have a question for Dr. Brook, please call in at 949-824-5824. That's 949-UCI-KUCI.
If you think you're safe in the sun, you're not. Five or more sunburns double your risk of developing skin cancer. It's your skin. Protect it. Brought to you by the American Academy of Dermatology. For more information, visit aad.org.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And we're back with...
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Okay, now we're back with Dr. Yaron Brook, who's the President and Executive Director for the Ayn Rand Institute. And if you have a question for Dr. Brook, you can call in at 949-UCI-KUCI. And Dr. Brook, what is the Ayn Rand Institute?
Well, the Ayn Rand Institute was founded in 1985. Ayn Rand died in 1982. It was founded in 85 in order to promote Ayn Rand's ideas in the culture. It really is an organization set up to try and get Ayn Rand read by more people, but more important, it incorporate Ayn Rand's ideas into the debate, into the discussion. Get her discussed on campuses. Get her taught in philosophy departments and in business schools. Get her ideas into the public debate. Try to have an influence at the university level, the high school level, but ultimately on the political level.
Yeah, why is Ayn Rand not taken so seriously in academic circles?
Well, I think she's not taken seriously because she is a true revolutionary. I think she's not taken seriously because she basically undercuts everything that's taught today in philosophy departments and in the humanities departments. She challenges over 2,000 years of teachings from the teachings of the Christian Church to the teachings of secular philosophies like Immanuel Kant and Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and all of the modern, postmodern junk that's out there. So by really confronting all these philosophies and really challenging their most basic premises and questioning everything, people who are being trained to think in terms of those philosophers view her as simplistic, view her as unserious, where indeed I think she is more complex, more serious than any of these other philosophers are, and it's time that she had a voice in these places. And indeed, when young people read her, when young people who still have open minds, who are still open to new ideas read her, they are really impacted, and at least a certain percentage of them take these ideas seriously.
Well, I think one of the reasons, and I've studied academic philosophy, I believe one of the reasons she's not taken so seriously is that she mostly wrote for a popular audience.
I think that's part of the reason, and indeed one of the efforts at the Institute is to train and support academic philosophers, philosophers in academic departments, and we're having quite a bit of success doing that. We've got now philosophers in philosophy departments, a number of philosophy departments around the country.
When you say we have philosophers, what does that mean?
That means that the Institute supports philosophers.
You mean like you endow chairs?
We have an endowed chair. We endow programs. So we have a fellowship for the study of objectivism at the University of Texas in Austin, a top 20 philosophy department. We have a faculty member there, a full professor, who teaches, among other things, she teaches Ayn Rand and objectivism. We have a program at the University of Pittsburgh philosophy department, which is the fifth-ranked philosophy department in the country, where we have, again, a fellowship for the study of objectivism. We have a number of programs at business schools where Atlas Shrugged is required reading as part of business ethics classes, and where she is taught and where Atlas Shrugged is handed out to every business student. So we're making inroads slowly. We're still a young philosophy. It takes time for revolutionary philosophy to get in, particularly when their position is so significant. And you're right. She didn't write in the language of academic philosophy.
Yeah, she was primarily a novelist, wasn't she?
And she was primarily a novelist, but she did write a book on epistemology, The Introduction to Epistemology. She did write The Virtue of Selfishness, which is the title of the talk that's been given on February 5th. She did write The Virtue of Selfishness, which is a book on ethics. I think, though, that academic philosophy and the way it writes, the way they write, is something we should question as well. It's much of it is incoherent. And should philosophy be incoherent? If it's supposed to make us understand the world better, if it's supposed to be a guide to life and a guide to reality, shouldn't it be in a language that is understood by more people? I think one of the challenges we face, and I think one of the challenges we will face in the future, is trying to change the language with which philosophers write. If you read Aristotle, I think he's much more understandable, and I think therefore much more relevant to human life than is, Schopenhauer, or certainly Immanuel Kant, and certainly many of the postmodernists who write today.
Have you read Aristotle?
Yes.
Okay, I have a hard time. I find him a pretty tough reader, frankly.
I mean, he's not easy. He's a challenge, but if you read his ethics, I think it's quite clear what he's trying to get to. And again, he wrote, let me note, that he wrote, well, about 2,400 years ago, 2,500 years ago. So what I'm saying is I think he's more understandable than many of today's philosophers who are writing today in a modern language.
I think that may be true. Now, I teach philosophy of science, and I think the philosophers of science, I think, are writing a lot better, at least it seems to me. Maybe it's just because I'm trained in this.
I'm not a trained philosopher, so okay. that might be a possibility, but of course I believe that philosophy of science, qua philosophy of science, is incredibly corrupt. And again, needs another revolution to bring reality back into science and to bring a correct epistemology and a respect for action back into the sciences. And I think we're drifting away from that because of the philosophy of science.
Oh,
so, for example, causality is an unpopular concept in the philosophy of science. How can you have science without causality?
Yeah, and causality is right. But do you have an example of what you think is the corrupt? Not that any philosopher of science has made a mistake, but a particular.
I'm not a technical philosopher. But again, causality, the law of causality, the fact that causality is not recognized, the law of identity, is questioned within the philosophy of science. Has been since both causality and identity, really since Hume. And I think that induction, which is a primary tool qua scientist of finding out anything about the world, has been dismissed for the sake of what I consider rationalism, this notion of developing theories that are unattached to any evidence in reality, and then building on those theories and building on those theories and building on those theories without testing them, much of it is building theory for the sake of theory. I just read an interview with somebody about string theory, and again, I'm not an expert, know nothing about string theory. Just a sentence struck me, and he said, if somebody asked him, is there any evidence, is there anything in reality that would suggest string? He said, no, that's not what this is about. This is about mathematically trying to explain theories that are unexplainable. I mean, it's a
fancy model that they're building. Yeah, and
but there's no connection to reality. Real science, if you look back at Newton, if you look at the discovery of the atom, if you look at the discovery of electricity, starts with observation. They start with reality. They start with trying to understand a phenomenon in the world, and then they accumulate evidence. And then through a process of inductive reasoning, they come to a theory. And then, of course, that theory is tested.
Yeah, well,
you start with reality and you end with reality. Those are the starting points and those are the ending points in science. You don't start with theory and then, maybe get around to reality at some point.
I just want to say I'm not sure you're quite being fair to the philosophy of science, because in the stuff that I'm having my students read, very much emphasizes observation, and that ultimately where the theories come from is somewhat mysterious, but ultimately they have to be tested with observation.
But
I agree that that's a problem with string theory that you mentioned.
But they have to come from observation as well. I don't agree with this notion that theories come to us through some kind of revelation. That if you study Newton, if you study Galileo, if you study the 19th century scientists to the electromagnetism and electricity, what you see them is looking at the world, experimenting, and then coming up with a theory to explain what they've experimented. And the theory is based on the observations and previous theory and some math, a combination of all three. And then testing, then making sure that it's consistent with everything else that they know. But they don't start with a theory like, I know from economics because I'm a former finance professor that, Milton Friedman has a very influential essay in economics. Look, you start out with a theory, you come up with something, doesn't matter where from, and then you test it. And if it can predict, it's a good theory. If it can't predict, it's a bad theory. And that's complete nonsense. You start in everything, including economics, you start with observation. You look at reality. You look at phenomena. You look at actual stuff that's going on, at economic phenomena that's going on, and you build a theory from that, and then you have a theory, and then you try to test it. But where the theory comes from is essential to whether the theory is true or not.
So you're very much committed to an idea of there being a logic of discovery that's
absolutely
not mysterious.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. On your website, one of the things I think that made this philosopher object is that on your website you said any material you have Ayn Rand's writings and then you have the writings of other people who have come after
her. Sure.
And any material there on your website should be judged with respect to its consistency with Ayn Rand's writings. Now, I think that's violating the rules. Shouldn't it be, because she doesn't get to be the, I don't think she should get to be the final authority on objectivism.
She is not the final authority on reality. She is not the final authority on truth, on what is right and what is wrong, necessarily. She is the final authority on what is objectivism. She defined a system. This is her system. It might be wrong. There might be errors in it. If you find an error, you call it Doug's theory of X, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But Ayn Rand came up with a set of ideas. She said, these are my ideas. I'm calling these ideas objectivism. And if you want to say this is an objectivist idea, the standard is it consistent with Ayn Rand? Now, if you find an error in Ayn Rand, that, you know, there's nothing to say there aren't errors in Ayn Rand, then that's fine. You say, I've discovered a new truth that contradicts what Ayn Rand said, that contradicts objectivism.
But the subheading of your institute is for the promotion of objectivism.
Yes.
Can you give us the full title?
The Center for the Advancement of Objectivism. We believe,
yeah.
I believe, that objectivism is true. That objectivism, you know, at least on the basic questions of philosophy, is complete, is accurate. And that's what we advance. We advance the study of her ideas. Now,
let me make an objection here.
Sure.
Pretty much every philosopher makes mistakes, right? Ayn Rand was human, and she made mistakes like anybody else, right?
That's possible. Yeah.
Okay, that's kind of a.
I'm not saying she made. I mean, I might disagree with her on certain issues, and I don't know, aesthetics or particular concretes here or there. But on no fundamental philosophical issue do I agree with her. Now, I'm not saying there's no error in there. I just haven't found it. Nobody I know and respect has. 100 years from now, somebody, you know, some new genius will come around and say, but then that'll be the new genius's theory, and that's fine. And I'll encourage that, and I think that's great. And I encourage people to expand on objectivism, to take her ideas and elaborate. Just don't call those elaborations. Don't call those expansions. Don't call that Ayn Rand's theory. That's not Ayn Rand's theory.
No,
that's your theory,
yeah, that's
expanding on Ayn Rand.
Right. Well, I think that's right. I think there's a difference between calling something Ayn Rand's theory, because these are the positions that she had,
yeah,
and that these might be the ones that are accepted, and these,
yeah,
might be the ones that we have problems with. But it's this take that she's got everything right. Because typically in philosophy, when you study most philosophers, we say, well, you know, they got a few things wrong here, and then other people have come along and tried to fix the ideas,
that's not how
philosophy works.
Yeah, but that's not how philosophy works. I mean, the way you should study philosophy is look at somebody's ideas and evaluate them. And if there's some errors and some things that are true, that's great. Some philosophers you read, and they're wrong from beginning to end. And Ayn Rand, I think, in my state of knowledge, from what I know about the world, is right from beginning to end about philosophy. I'm not saying that will always be the case. I'm saying that her particular philosophy, if you're talking about what Kant said, you're talking about what Kant said, and there are people today who study Kant who've changed him. That's not Kant's philosophy. That's their interpretation on what he said. The people who study Aristotle, and they try to reflect what Aristotle really said, they're called Aristotelian scholars. But then there might be people who say, like Spinoza, for example, who take Aristotle's philosophy and take it in a different direction. Well, we don't call them Aristotelians. We call them Spinoza. We call them something else. I'm not objecting to people taking Ayn Rand's philosophy and building on it, and maybe even saying, you know, I think this point is wrong. Let's debate that. But don't say that what you're presenting is objectivist when you are presenting your correction on objectivism. Say, this is objectivism. This is what Ayn Rand taught. I'm presenting it to you the way she would have wanted it presented. And hey, I object. I think this is different and that is different. That's fine. I think that would be wonderful if professors at university did that. if they took her ideas seriously, presented her ideas, and then, you know, presented their objections to her ideas. I think that's, you know, and told their students, I think she's wrong from beginning to end. Whatever they want to say about her is fine, as long as they present their ideas and do those ideas justice.
Well, wasn't there a personality cult that evolved around, when Ayn Rand was alive, that evolved around her? And isn't this kind of this attitude that she got everything right, isn't this possibly a reflection of that personality cult, which can be a big problem?
Well, let me just say, I didn't say she got everything right. Not every utterance.
I'm sorry, all of the main philosophical points.
I think all of the main philosophical points she got right. You know, there's a lot written about the history of, or there's been some written, most of it, I think, pretty inaccurate, about life surrounding Ayn Rand in the 50s and 60s. I wasn't there, so I don't know. There will be indeed a book coming out, I think next month, called The Passion of Ayn Rand's Critics, that addresses some of the more egregious things that people have said about her and about this supposed cult that surrounded her. So I encourage anybody who's read some of the other biographies out there to read that book, if you're interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, let me tell you,
I don't find it that interesting. I mean, I find ideas interesting, and I think from everything I've heard about Ayn Rand, for people who knew her, she was a magnificent person, and a nice person, and a good moral person. You know, but if you want to get into of her biography, there are books out there. We just published at the Institute, well, we just published, one of our writers published a short biography of Ayn Rand that's available in the bookstores by Overlook Press. The author's Jeff Britting. So there's plenty of material about there. People should go out there and make up their own minds. I would hasten to say that most of what was being written about Ayn Rand's life is just plain wrong.
Okay. Who was Nathaniel Brandon? I understand he was a protege of hers. Tell us the story about Nathaniel Brandon and Ayn Rand.
Yeah, Nathaniel Brandon approached, again, and this I know second, third hand. I'm certainly not an expert on her biography certainly not an expert on Nathaniel. Approached Ayn Rand when she was young. He'd read The Fountainhead and was a huge admirer and met her when he was young, and was involved with the movement around her through 1968, I think. He actually founded something called the Nathaniel Brandon Institute, where they would do lectures on Ayn Rand and she would lecture and he would lecture about her philosophy. And in 1968 had a split between Ayn Rand and him. I think the split centered primarily around the fact that he no longer believed in these ideas. And indeed, if you read his book, and if you read this book I mentioned a minute ago about The Passion of Ayn Rand's Critics...
Wasn't there more to their relationship than that, though?
Yeah, okay. I know you want to get there. I'll get that, I promise.
Okay.
He basically stopped believing in those ideas, and she realized that, and I think he realized that, although he for years and years and years dissed her about this. And as a consequence, they split, and he went his own way, and he lives in California here somewhere, and opened up a psychology practice, and has written his books and done his thing, including leech and live off of Ayn Rand's name for many, many years, because, you know, she sells books, and if he wrote a book about Ayn Rand, he made a lot of money off of it. It also turns out that, and I don't know the exact dates, but starting about 5 years, I think, after they met, with the knowledge of both spouses, both Nathaniel's wife and Ayn Rand's husband, they had an affair that until through the 60s. And I know people love to mention that and make a big deal out of that. Well, I don't understand exactly why.
Well, here's the thing that bothered me about that, because they seem to, according to what I read now, my source is Michael Shermer's White People Believe Weird Things. He has a chapter on Ayn Rand in there.
Well, it's a very distorted, perverted chapter. So
okay.
I wouldn't necessarily believe what Michael Shermer has written about Ayn Rand.
But now here's the thing.
Because his sources, not because, I mean, Michael Shermer has his own problems, but not because, I mean, philosophically I think he has problems. But not because, you know,
he's a nice guy. I've met him.
Yeah, I'm sure he is. I've heard him on the radio. Yeah. He sounds nice. But his sources are bad. I mean, his sources are primarily books written by the Brandons. I mean, that's the primary source on Ayn Rand, unfortunately. And both the Brandons are wrong.
Because one of the things is that, according to Shermer's book, is that they declared their affair rational. You know, they kind of wrapped it up in Ayn Rand's philosophy.
Sure, absolutely.
Instead of... Which seems to be, that's the real critic. Instead of just their people having a naughty affair, okay, who cares?
But it wasn't naughty. I mean, you define naughty as something that is deceptive, that's something that's wrong. Ayn Rand didn't believe it was wrong. I don't necessarily, again, I wasn't there, I don't know the detail, but I don't necessarily think it was wrong. Their spouses were aware of it. The spouses stayed with them through it. And these are not, particularly Ayn Rand's husband was not an insignificant person, and he stayed with it. So I believe that it was, could have been, you know, again, it wasn't a rational thing, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it. We need to get away from this Judeo-Christian morality that says that, you know, sex somehow is bad, and that the only moral system is, a monogamous system sanctioned by marriage and so on. You know, an affair can be appropriate and can be rational. If you read Atlas Shrugged, one of the main characters in Atlas Shrugged has an affair, which I think is completely rational for him to do and completely right for him to do in that, in the context set up in the novel. So just because somebody has sex out of wedlock or while they're married does not make that person irrational.
Oh, I wouldn't say it's irrational. It was the claiming of the rational. But let's move on.
But claiming it's rational when it is rational is fine.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with it.
Let's move on. You've given a talk at a number of colleges called The Moral Case for Israel. And I happen to agree with you that there is a moral case to be made on behalf of Israel. But isn't there a problem for an objectivist trying to tell people, you know, that they're supposed to act in their best interest? Shouldn't the title of your talk be you're self-interested in case, you know, why Israel's health is good for you?
Well, when I talk about the moral case for anything, you know, we're talking about Ayn Rand's morality, and I make it clear in the talk. I'm talking about why it's good for you, why it's good for America, and why it's good for individual Americans. That Israel be a successful country, that it thrive and it succeed in defeating its enemies. I think it's important for individual American citizens that Israel defeat the terrorists that are trying to destroy it.
So your case is not just a case, the moral case is that, because I think a lot of lies, especially on the college campus, I think a lot of lies get told about Israel. I think that's unfair.
Huge amount of lies get told about Israel, and that's part of my talk. Because in order for me to argue that Israel's survival and Israel's existence and Israel's defeating terrorism is in your individual case, you have to make a case that Israel, qua a country, is a good country. Because I don't think it's ever in your interest to support a country that's evil, that's bad. And all the stuff that gets taught on campuses, that gets preached on campuses, is nonsense. I actually debated one of your, and I wish I could remember his name, but one of your very
is
prominent...
Is this Mark Levine?
Yeah, I debated Levine here on campus.
He's been on this show in the past.
Yeah, and we debated Israel. I think it was a 2.5-3 hour debate. It was quite...
Wow.
Quite noisy and quite exciting. On some of those lies, which he is one of the chief promulgators at UCI, of the lies about Israel. He's got a new book out, which is again full of lies about Israel. So I think it's important to diffuse and to make clear that these are lies and what is the true history of the state of Israel and why it is fighting in self-defense and why it is a country that is in the self-interest of Americans to support.
Yeah, well, let me give you that, because I think that all these lies, and I think it has a right to exist and to defend itself. But why is it in the interest of Americans to give them billions of dollars of aid every year?
Oh, it's not. By supporting Israel, I do not mean financially supporting Israel. I'm against foreign aid, period. I just think that Israel, of all the foreign aid we give in the world, Israel is probably the best country to give foreign aid to. You know, we give the Palestinians hundreds of millions of dollars, which support their terrorist activities against America and Israel. We give Egypt as much money as we give the Israelis. We throw money around at problems all over the world. We try to make people love us at every corner of the world, and nobody does. Money never buys you love. What would really buy America love is if we actually stood up for our principle and actually advocated for individual rights around the world for a change, and not majoritarian democracy as we are in Iraq right now. But I do not believe Israel should get economic aid from the United States. However, of all the foreign aid we give, it is probably the best candidate, if there is such a.
Okay. And we're running out of time. And so before I ask you anything more, I know we only have about 3 minutes left. Let me ask you to tell any listeners who've tuned in about your upcoming events. If we still have time, I'll ask you the last question.
On Friday night, we have a free talk by Peter Schwartz, who's chairman of the board of directors, on the virtue of selfishness.
I'm sorry, which Friday night?
This is Friday, February, I think it's the 5th.
I think it's the 4th. I think it's the 4th.
Yeah,
I mean,
you're giving the wrong day. You're right, because the 2nd is a Wednesday.
Yeah.
It's a Friday, February 4th, at the Westin in South Coast Plaza. And again, if you go to our website, you can get more information about that. It's Saturday, the 5th.
And your website is Ayn Rand.org?
Ayn Rand.org, AYNRAND.org. You can also go to objectivistconferences.com, which has a lot of information about these events. This is the 100th anniversary to Ayn Rand's birth. February 2nd is, and the whole weekend is a bunch of lectures and a fabulous dinner Saturday night with very prominent objectivist philosophers and intellectuals, and it's going to be a fascinating and fun weekend.
Okay, well, Dr. Brook, let me ask you one more question. I only feel like I've got through half of my questions.
Well, yeah, have to have me back.
Yeah, I hope that you will come back again.
Absolutely.
Someday. But let me ask you just a kind of a fun question. Were any of Ayn Rand's books made into movies, and were any of them any good?
Two of them were made into movies. The Fountainhead with Gary Cooper and Patricia Neal, and it's okay. I don't think it's a great movie, and it was made into movies in the 50s. The second movie, which I think is a really good movie, was We the Living. It was actually, and it's an interesting story behind the making of the movie. It was made in Italy in the early 1940s in Italian, and it stars Anita Valli, who's a wonderful, wonderful actress. And it was made kind of under Mussolini's nose. And he thought that this movie, because it's anti-communist, would serve its purposes because, of course, the fascists were fighting the communists. But as soon as it was released, it was clear that the movie was not just anti-communist, but was anti any totalitarian regime, and indeed anti-fascist. And Mussolini immediately shut down the movie and had every copy burnt. And luckily,
wow,
somebody saved one copy, and the copy was rediscovered, I think it was in the 1960s, and then it was, and Ayn Rand never knew that this existed, never knew the movie was made. They never asked for the rights. She saw it in, I think, in the 60s, early 70s, and actually helped redo the subtitle, create subtitles for it, and I think did a little bit of editing to it. And it's a fabulous movie.
So
it's out on DVD.
It's out on DVD.
It's a high-quality movie, not just a great story.
And it's available in subtitle version, right? So I don't have to speak Italian?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Available in subtitle version. You can get it from the AynRandBookstore.com, A-Y-N-R-E-N-D, bookstore.com, all one word. Again, if you go to our website, AynRand.org, you can link to the bookstore. It truly is. It's good Italian cinema with a good aesthetic qualities, great acting, and of course a great Ayn Rand story.
Okay, Dr. Brook from the Ayn Rand Institute, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
If you want more information, go to his website at AynRand.org. We will have a link up to that on our webpage at KUCI.org/TildeDoug. Just go to the KUCI.org website, click on Tuesday morning, 9 a.m. So if you're driving, you don't have to write that down, although AynRand.org is pretty easy, AynRand.org. So please stay tuned next week. Mark Hart will be hosting the show next week. I will see you in 2 weeks on this show. And please stay tuned for more great talk and music here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Hi, this is Chancellor Ralph Cicerone, and you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
Learn firsthand about another culture without leaving the United States to establish a friendship that will last a lifetime. PIE has international students from more than 40 countries arriving into the area for homestay programs, and they need your help. The nonprofit organization is looking for a few more caring host families to share the American way of life. If you think you may be interested in hosting a foreign team or would like more information about the program, please call immediately at 1-800-828-9001. That's 1-800-828-9001.
Some thoughts from John Cleese.
A hotel in Miami is called Hawaii. There is also a motel in Hawaii called Miami. The place that seems romantic and special is always somewhere else. Those who grow oranges in their backyards love apple orchards. Those with an apple tree or two dream of oranges. What seems most desirable is always the thing we don't have. If we could only see our homes and possessions the way others see them, perhaps we would no longer take them for granted. We could then realize that it matters little whether we live in Miami or Hawaii. Each place is beautiful in its own right.
A message from the Philosophers of America, celebrating 100 years of thought.
Oh, hello, special lady. I think it's time for a little one-on-one conversation. Talking about my baby, baby. Oh, not you, baby. Our baby, baby. A recent scientific study of lactation. Magical lady, gonna get down to business. Gonna turn the lights down on you for a slideshow on childhood disease resistance. Wonderful woman, if you do breastfeed, a little baby will be at less risk for respiratory illnesses. Hey, I'm just talking about breastfeeding. Educate your sweet self at 800-994-WOMAN or 4woman.gov or talk to your health care provider. Babies were born to be breastfed exclusively for 6 months. This public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station. Baby.
Laura's House is the comprehensive domestic violence service program in South Orange County. Laura's House provides services to the entire family in an effort to break the multi-generational cycle of violence and help create healthier families. If you are in need of services, the following programs are available, all in the 949 area code. A crisis 24-hour hotline at